From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, John Hiatt talks about writing songs for himself and others. He wrote Bonnie Raitt's hit, Thing Called Love. Also today, Dave Thomas on comedy. On SETV, Thomas was known for his impressions of Bob Hope and Walter Cronkite, and for co-creating The Great White North with Rick Moranis. Now Thomas has a CBS summer comedy series. And John Leonard reviews a new book on the life and legend of Cleopatra. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush won a narrow victory today as the Senate failed to override his veto of a funding measure for Amtrak. It takes a two-thirds vote in each House to override a presidential veto. The Senate vote to override was only 64-36. A vote to override the veto sailed through the House last week. A parliamentary maneuver by Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell will allow Democrats to bring the measure back for another attempt to override the president's veto. Also on Capitol Hill, the Senate Ethics Committee today opened a public hearing into allegations against GOP Senator Dave Durenberger of Minnesota. It's the first time in 9 years that the committee's held a public hearing on the financial dealings of a senator. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Durenberger is accused of trying to circumvent Senate rules limiting the amount of outside income or honoraria that members of the Senate can make. The charges against him were presented today by the committee's special counsel, Robert Bennett. Bennett said that Durenberger made a deal with a small publishing company in Minnesota, Piranha Press, to publish two of his books. Then Bennett said Durenberger made speeches, calling them book promotions, and had the payments for those speeches sent to his publisher, who in turn sent the money to him. Bennett described the scheme as a money laundering gimmick. Durenberger's lawyer did not refute the facts of the allegation, but he argued that although the senator had been inattentive and unwise, he never intended to violate Senate rules and always acted in good faith. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Crews working on the leaking oil tanker off the Texas coast are making progress. They say they've got the fires under control. Kathy Lohr has more from Galveston, Texas.
Crews have extinguished the fire in the pump room. Fire in the accommodations area of the tanker is still burning, but oil is no longer burning on the water. Federal on-site coordinator, U.S. Coast Guard Captain Tom Green, says it's good the crews are getting fires under control, but bad for the environment that the fire is no longer burning oil as it pours from the tanker.
That now increases the pollution, the amount of oil that's going on the water. It's not being consumed by the fire. However, we have 8 commercial skimming devices out there in operation in the area that are coping with that oil.
Green has no estimate yet on how much oil is leaking from the vessel now. Crews sprayed chemical dispersants on the spill yesterday and this morning, but they still have not cooled the ship enough to use the foam brought in from Europe to put out the fire. For National Public Radio, I'm Kathy Lohr in Galveston, Texas.
The Coast Guard says there's little danger of further leakage from a cruise ship that ran aground Sunday off Cape Cod. Cleanup crews have started to pick up oil from the shores of an island off the Cape. Prices were sharply higher today on Wall Street, boosted by a wave of computerized program buying late in the day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 41 points today. The index closed at 2,933.42 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. 7 states are suing the Mobil Corporation, saying that the company's claims for its hefty garbage bags are false. Massachusetts announced today it would seek damages under the state's Consumer Protection Act. Madeline Brand of member station WBUR reports.
The Massachusetts suit charges the bags decompose no faster than ordinary plastic bags when disposed of in landfills. Attorney General James Shannon is seeking $5,000 for each violation of the Consumer Protection Act. That could mean a penalty for each box of garbage bags sold in the state. But Shannon says the message the lawsuit sends is more important.
If they can make the claims without having to show that these are in fact environmentally sound products, then it's going to undercut all of our efforts to develop products that are going to be better for the environment.
Massachusetts joins California, Texas, Wisconsin, New York, and Washington in filing suit against Mobil. Mobil discontinued the ad campaign in March. For National Public Radio, this is Madeline Brand in Boston.
House Speaker Thomas Foley said today that the House will take action within a month on a constitutional amendment to outlaw desecration of the American flag. Foley has said that he personally opposes changing the First Amendment, but that he's promised Republicans that a constitutional amendment on flag protection would be considered within 30 days if the Supreme Court overruled the Federal Flag Protection Act. The court ruled yesterday that the act violates the freedom of speech provisions in the First Amendment. Foley said he thought the vote on the amendment would be close. He said he'd urge other lawmakers to oppose the amendment, but wouldn't make the vote a party issue. A Louisiana State Senate committee has approved a bill that would reduce the maximum penalty for beating up someone who burns an American flag. The approval came a day after the U.S. Supreme Court voided the Federal Flag Protection Act. The bill was passed by the State House on Memorial Day. It goes next to the Louisiana State Senate. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Bonnie Raitt's 1989 album Nick of Time revived her career. It also gave a boost to the career of John Hyatt, who wrote the album's hit Thing Called Love. Hyatt's songs have also been recorded by Bob Dylan, the Neville Brothers, Roseanne Cash, and the Everly Brothers, but Hyatt hasn't yet had a hit of his own. In 1985, Hyatt gave up long-term addictions to alcohol and drugs. His next two albums, Bring the Family and Slow Turning, received widespread critical acclaim and were described in Rolling Stone magazine as two of the finest albums of the 80s. John Hyatt has a new album called Stolen Moments. This is the title song.
I used to drink a lot in those days, you see. Yeah, that's the way the wind blows. These days the only bar I ever see has got lettuce and tomatoes. I get pumped up in the back of my
Hyatt, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's nice to be here, Terry.
I think one of the things people really like about your lyrics is that they're written from the perspective of someone who's been around a while. I mean, you write about adult love. Do you know what I mean? And you write about complex emotions. You write stories in your lyrics. Were you always confident that stuff like that could be fit into a lyric and expressed in a song?
You know, I think basically I've just been bluffing because I don't know the first thing about adult love. I do try and act like I know something about it, but golly, I'm talk about your arrested development, emotionally speaking, Terry. You got the original right here. I've sort of always written about love, I guess.
When you were a young man, you went to...
I'm still a young man,
Terry. That didn't come out right, did it? when you were very young, you were in your early 20s or something, or even a teenager, I'm not sure which, you went to Nashville, and you became a house writer for a music publishing company.
Yes.
And I'd love to hear what life was like inside a publishing company where you really had to churn it out every day.
Yeah, well, I didn't actually do that. There wasn't a lot of people are under the impression that there's like quota writing and that sort mm-hmm. of thing, which may have been the case in some houses, but it wasn't at Tree, which is where I wrote. But what you had there was you had a lot of great craftsmen. I'm thinking of writers when I was there. You had writers like Curly Putnam, who wrote The Green, Green Grass of Home, and a fellow named Bobby Braddock was somebody I looked up to, wrote hits for George Jones and Tammy Wynette and people like that. And I was very young and very, I was very intent on not writing, you know, anything that even resembled a country song. I was, you know, the rebel from the North, if that's possible. And, you know, I really didn't know how good I had it there until after the fact. I look back on those times today, and I really feel like through maybe just through osmosis, because I really was too much of a knucklehead to pick it up at the time. But I feel like just being around those guys, I learned a lot just about the craft of songwriting.
What were your very early songs like when you first went to Nashville?
Pretty bad. Pretty gosh darn bad. Salesman dying, hanging by the necktie. And pretty real overly dramatic kind of stuff. And it hasn't gotten a whole lot better.
How would performers get matched up with your songs? Did they come directly to you? Did they go to the publishing house?
In those days?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I had two songs covered, I think, in 5 years. So my biggest hit, so to speak, during those Tree years was a song that a group called Three Dog Night heard and covered. It was a song called Sure As I'm Sitting Here. And but see, I really wasn't writing the kind of tunes that you could take around the corner to Billy Sherrill and get George Jones to record, and that's kind of how it worked down there in those days. You could write a song on Wednesday and they'd play it for Billy on Thursday. George would cut it on Friday and it'd be out on Monday, or so it seemed.
A lot of people have recorded your songs over the years. Do you hear new qualities in one of your songs when someone else sings them?
All the time, yeah, absolutely. It's a real thrill, you know, to hear someone interpret you.
Let me play you singing the song that Bonnie Raitt recorded on her record that was a big hit, and this was a really important record in her career. And this is your song, Thing Called Love, that you recorded this on your 1987 album, Bring the Family. Let's play it, and then I want to ask you a couple of things about
okay,
it.
Okay, great.
Don't have to humble yourself to me. I need to judge all your claim. Baby, you know you ain't no Queen of Sheba. We may not even have our own dignity, no. This could be just a prideful thing. Baby, we can choose, you know we ain't no amoebas.
It's John Hyatt singing his own song, Thing Called Love. When you hear yourself do it and hear Bonnie Raitt do the same song, what do you think of as being the differences in your interpretations of it?
Well, I'd say right off the bat, she was a little more, a lot more sort of sultry, sexy about it all, you know, as only she can be. I kind of was like a little more like a bull in a china closet, you know. Which is kind of my approach. And, I loved her version of it. Of course, she has such a wonderful voice, but then you couple that with that, her slide style is, you know, silky and really dirty at the same time, and I really think she did it great on that song.
So what was going on in your life that inspired the song?
Well, those very items, you know, putting it on the line in terms of that thing called love. You know, I had met my wife and I was going after her with much fervor and commitment and dedication and trying wholeheartedly to convince her that I was worth the risk, even though on paper maybe I didn't add up to such a good shot. So it had very much to do with my life at the time.
In 1987, your record Bring the Family came out, and I think this was the first album that you made after giving up drugs and alcohol. How much do you think that the changes you made in your life accounted for the changes in your career?
Well, I think the effect it had was a pretty simple mathematical one. When you when you, I spend so much time procuring and consuming, you know, alcohol and dope, and you know, spending great amounts of time and energy in that lifestyle, that I really didn't have, you know, my work suffered, basically. You just don't have a whole lot of time to sit down and write tunes when you're out there, you know, doing the lambada, so to speak.
You said that you lived in bars back in the days, that you were a drinker. Did you go to neighborhood bars or more music industry type bars? You know, like entertainment biz bars?
No, I kind of shunned those places, except when I'd want to really work up a good resentment and drink at people. You know, I used to kind of dig that, drinking at people. Then I'd go to those bars because I'd need some grist for the mill, you know.
Yeah. So,
boy, I'd drink at them. Yeah, I'd drink at them, and of course, did a lot of good. You know, they didn't change, and so... And of course, why the hell should they? They were just fine. It turned out that old JH had to do some changing, you know. Ooh. And of course, that's something we don't like. It's a nasty job having to work on yourself, don't you think, Terry?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Were you sociable when you got drunk?
Well, I think to a point. I think to a point, but then I would turn. See. This the evil twin Skippy would come out.
Right.
Yeah. And golly, he got into trouble.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is singer-songwriter, guitarist John Hiatt, and he has a new record out called Stolen Moments. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
John Hiatt is my guest, and he has a new album out called Stolen Moments, and we'll be hearing some more from it in just a couple of minutes. You have a song on your new record called 30 Years of Tears.
Yeah.
Is the 30 years an allusion to the years that you... Well, I guess you're not old enough to...
Yes, I've been drinking since I was seven, Terry.
Right.
A wee lad of seven. Had my first dram. Irish whiskey it was.
So what?
Actually, it's not that far off. I think I tipped my first half pint of Dark Eyes cherry vodka when I was about 12.
Uh-huh.
So...
So what are the 30 years that you're referring to?
Well, that tune kind of came out of a rough spot in our marriage, where some pain, that personal pain that I you know, you don't want to have to face this stuff, and I was faced with, you know, remnants stuff hanging around in me that I'd been lugging around with me, you know, suitcases full, buckets of tears and things. And I was trying to pin them on events, current events, when in fact they were old. It was old stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's hear the record.
Okay.
This is John Hiatt from his new album, Stolen Moments. The song is 30 Years of Tears.
This is a place I can rest my poor head, to gather my thoughts in sweet silence. And is this a place where the feelings aren't dead from an overexposure to violence? Slowly face only one I truly can know. These are tears from a long time ago. I've got these tears from a long time ago, and I need to cry 30 years or so. These are tears
from a long time ago.
John Hyatt from his new album, Stolen Moments. We were talking about the problems that you had till around 1985. What got you to stop? What got you to stop doing drugs and drinking?
Nobleness on my part. It was really just it had whipped me soundly.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't have any choice. That pretty much sums it up.
Did you have to learn to perform without being high? Was it a different experience for
you? Yeah, it sure was. It was kind of tricky at first. Woo!
What did you have to do to get the feel for it?
Well, I had to tough it out. I went out. I remember I went out on my first tour with about 6 months. I'd been sober about 6 months. And I'll tell you what I did. I had my little conversation with whoever runs the show, and I don't pretend to know what or who that is. And I said to this entity that I was willing to stop doing this if it meant that I couldn't do it and stay sober. And then ensued about 3 weeks of touring that, you know, I'd be up on stage, and in the middle of a song, I'd be talking to myself in my head, going, "What are you doing up here? You're bluffing. This is, you're a fake. You're a phony. What is this? You're not in touch with your. What are you even singing about? You know, really wondering about the whole deal." And then after about, it seemed like 3-4 weeks into the tour, I started to get a sort of a sense of the music. And it was almost like, not to get corny about it, but what the hell? It felt like the gift of music was kind of slowly being given back to me somehow. It was a nice thing. And so I feel like in finally being willing to let go of it, I got it back.
What about the process of writing songs? Was that any harder or easier when you became sober?
It took me. I couldn't really write anything to speak of for about a year, and there again, I had to be willing to do that. I had to be willing to go through that, and I've since met writers who have had alcohol or drug problems and have gotten clean and sober and have had a similar problem.
You know, I haven't seen any pictures of you when you were
handsome.
Very young. No. I've seen pictures recently, but I should say you're in the New York Bureau and I'm in Philadelphia, so we are not looking at each other face to face now. But, I've seen plenty of pictures of you, and you're a very lean guy now, but I've read about you that you're a very fat kid.
Yeah.
And it's just hard for me to imagine because you look nearly gaunt on your photographs now. I mean, did the dissolute lifestyle thin you out?
I've got this eating eating disorder whacked out kind of guy too, see? And so I go from one, I went from being obese, you know, food was kind of used as dope at my house when I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
It served to, you know, fill up the hole. You know, anything we could get to stuff down in there. But what I found for me is I went the other way and started, you know, trying to starve myself to death, thinking that maybe that would make it all better. And that doesn't work either. So I'm trying to strike a balance. It's a daily kind of deal.
Did you perform or write songs when you were a kid?
I started writing when I was 11, Terry.
That's a kid. That's pretty young.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been writing for over a quarter of a century.
Was it hard to imagine yourself on stage as a rock performer when you were very heavy?
No, it was as easy as picking up my brother's tennis racket and standing in front of the mirror, and it's almost like I would leave my body, and all of a sudden I'd transform into like Elvis Presley or somebody like that.
We talked. You lived in Nashville and wrote songs there when you were very young, and I think you're living back in Nashville again. Right?
I sure am. Yeah, I moved back 5 years ago.
What brought you back there?
Well, I had I've all of a sudden found myself a single parent, and I had a daughter a year old, and I was living in Los Angeles, and I just figured, you know, where can I go that I might could pull this off? And Nashville just came to mind as a place, you know, maybe, I thought to myself, maybe me and this little girl will have a chance of pulling through down there in Nashville. And it turned out to be a really good move for me. I met my wife there.
On a more professional level, is Nashville a good place for a songwriter now? I mean, does that matter to you that you're there when you're writing songs that other people might record?
Well, you know, I really like being there as a songwriter for the simple reason that it's a respected profession in that town.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, Hollywood is historically kind of tough on its writers. They never have treated them real well. And I'm speaking very generally, but... I just like the way the songwriter is held in some esteem. I don't think it's beyond the importance of the craft. But I do think that they assign it some kind of dignity as far as a creative professional skill goes, and I like that.
Do you sit at a desk and write your songs?
I don't. I've gotten a lot more flexible with that. I used to have to be in a certain room at a certain time with a certain guitar and pencils sharpened and notepads and all that kind of thing, legal pads. In the last 3 years or so with the kids, you know, we had a new baby 2 years ago. She's not a baby anymore, but now with three kids and the... you know, working more as the career kicks up a little bit here, I've had to be more flexible in terms of where and when I can write. And that means, you know, in the back of a tour bus or let's see, maybe if I go in, you know, this bedroom upstairs, you know, I can get away for 10 or 15 minutes before Georgia comes storming in and says, "What are you doing, Daddy?" So, you know, it's kind of catch as catch can, and it's really served to loosen me up, I think, in a good way as a writer.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking to us about your life and your music. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
John Hyatt's new album is called Stolen Moments. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Reverend Joseph Engel, he ministers to death row inmates and is the director of the Southern Coalition on Jails and Prisons. Hope you can join us.
Went to college, babe. I did not have the luck. Stole out of Indiana in the back of a pickup truck. With no education higher than the streets of my hometown, I went looking for a fire just to burn it all down. You got a real fine love. You got a real fine love. One eye.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Dave Thomas tells us why he's finally getting around to stand-up. Thomas is a veteran of the SCTV comedy series and the host of a summer comedy series on CBS. And John Leonard reviews a new book that says everything you know about Cleopatra is wrong. It's called Cleopatra, History's Dreams and Distortions by historian Lucy Hughes Hallett. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The new government of Israel sought to define its policies today. The prime minister put the burden of peace talks on his Arab neighbors, while other members of the government talked of tough measures against the continued Palestinian uprising. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Jerusalem.
The new government's priorities include a peace process based on talks with Arab governments rather than the Palestinians and expanding Jewish settlements in Israel's occupied territories. In a report tonight on Israel Radio, the new interior minister promised to speed up Jewish settlers moving to the occupied Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, a Jewish religious student was stabbed today in Jerusalem's Old City. And in Gaza, Israeli soldiers lobbed a tear gas canister in a maternity clinic, injuring more than 60 infants. An army spokesman said tonight that the army is taking legal action against one soldier. The spokesman said a large group of Palestinians were inside the clinic and were throwing stones at the soldiers. In Jerusalem, this is Deborah Amos.
Soviet leader Gorbachev said today that he would agree to a unified Germany in NATO if it would also have an associate membership in the Warsaw Pact. However, he said this plan has been turned down by Western nations. Gorbachev told the Supreme Soviet that dual German membership in NATO and the Warsaw Pact would be impossible, though, without changes in both alliances and progress in conventional forces talks. In Washington, President Bush said again that he is determined that a unified Germany become a full member of NATO with no conditions. After 2 days of talks in Bonn, African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela failed to get promises from top West German officials to continue economic sanctions against South Africa. Deidre Berger has more.
South African black leader Nelson Mandela rated his talks a success with West German government officials. Mandela said Chancellor Helmut Kohl promised to look into the question of continued sanctions. Mandela said he and Kohl also agreed to hold regular consultations on the issue. Mandela is on a six-week tour of Western capitals. He is pushing for a continuance of European community sanctions against the white-ruled government until blacks achieve equal rights in South Africa. Despite the friendly reception Mandela received in Bonn, he's leaving without a firm commitment to support his position. Observers in Bonn said West German officials might push for a partial relaxation of sanctions against South Africa in the fields of sport and culture. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
On Capitol Hill, the Senate has failed to get enough votes to override a presidential veto of legislation providing federal support for Amtrak. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 40 points to close at 2,933.42 on volume of some 157 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dave Thomas, but you also know him as Bob Hope, Walter Cronkite, and half of the McKenzie Brothers, hosts of The Great White North. Thomas was one of the Canadian comic actors who starred on the SCTV comedy series. Now he has his own five-part comedy series, Monday Nights on CBS. Each program opens with a monologue. This week, Thomas gave some tips on how to do an impression of Bob Hope.
I've noticed some things about Bob, some little idiosyncrasies that perhaps some of you have noticed, like when Bob is talking about beautiful and sexy women, his voice goes up very high, like this.
Hey, here's Stevie Nicks with her new hit single, and then joining me later in the show will be Kiki D with the pretty baby herself, Miss Brooke Shields, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, right here on the show.
But when Bobby is referring to important people, his voice drops way down, you know, like this.
Now, I did 9 holes with Maggie Thatcher the other day,
and I'll tell you, the Iron Lady can really smack a ball, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and we were out there with Malcolm Forbes and General Westmoreland, and then
Gerald Ford joined us on the back nine.
And then we went to the lounge, and Kiki D was in there, and we had a drink with her.
Let me ask you to describe your vision of the show.
The idea of the show was to do a fast-paced sketch show, you know, with some kind of a home base reality that was the network's idea, of course. They like to be able to come back to the same place in case people become as frightened as they are. Anyway, so I just wanted to make the average length of the sketches about 2 minutes so that in a 23-minute show, I'd be able to have about 8 or 10 pieces in a show, you know, so that hopefully if a sketch wasn't funny, and no one thinks this, you know, no two people think the same thing is funny, commonly anyway, so that if someone didn't find it funny, at least it would be short enough that we would be on to the next one before they became really frustrated.
My favorite characterization of yours is Bob Hope.
And yeah.
I was wondering how you first did him.
Well, I'll tell you. What happened there was we were doing a thing. We wrote a... Brian Doyle Murray, Bill's brother, and I wrote a thing called the Bob Hope Desert Classic, which kind of combined two things that were real tough, close to Bob at that time, and that was golf and war. So I really didn't know how to do them. I'd never done them before. I'd done kind of just the high, whiny voice of Bob Hope here in... we're in Phnom Penh, 50 miles north of the DMZ, you know. So I was working it, but I hadn't really sort of refined it. And then when we got into makeup and they put this, this was pre-prosthetics, and they put a wax nose on me. And I looked in the mirror and I said, gee, I still don't look like him. And they slicked my hair back and grayed it a little. And then Beverly Checkman, who was the makeup designer, said, well, why don't you stick your jaw out, you know, because his jaw is bigger than yours. So as soon as I stuck my jaw out, I had kind of a little cup that I could speak into in the front here. And that, for all you lame impersonators out there that are trying to do them, that's the secret to how to do them. And the minute someone else gets them down, then I'll stop doing them too. So, but he was at a book signing in Century City yesterday, and a friend of mine dropped by and took a copy of his latest book to him to sign for me and said that he was very impressed that he had seen the shows. And he thinks that kid who does him is wild, you know.
On SCTV, you used to do Bob Hope to Rick Moranis' Woody Allen.
Yep.
Who came up with the idea to put the two characters together?
Well, Rick could do Woody, and I had done Bob. So, you know, we were always fooling around in the offices and kind of packaging unlikely combinations of people that would be put together, you know. And so we barked this thing into one of those little micro cassette recorders one day, and it came out quite funny, the Play It Again Bob thing that we ended up doing with Woody and Bob together. So we decided to write it up as a sketch from the notes, and we changed very little really from what we improvised, and we shortened it, of course, but we changed very little of the structure of the piece. And we just thought that Woody had, especially in his earlier comedy, not like Interiors and darker stuff like that they did later, but in his earlier comedies he borrowed a lot from Bob Hope. He played the coward character and was always kind of like backing out a door with gorillas, you know, like he'd take the money and run. Yeah, you guys, well, I no you guys. And Bob Hope was like, yeah, listen, hey, but I'm not the guy. So that sort of borrowing the coward character, and he added the sort of neurosis touch. So we played with that in the piece, you know, that Bob would be talking to Woody about doing something together, but Bob wouldn't want to get into all that New York neurosis stuff that Woody, you know, was into, that kind of stuff.
Did you ever do jokes yourself?
When?
You know, stand-up jokes, yeah.
When I was a kid, you mean, or stand-up comedy?
Stand-up comedy.
No, I just started doing this. Ironically, I decided to wait till I was 40 to try stand-up. You know, all the other guys that are down there at these clubs are 20 years old, and so I kind of creak in and try my jokes out. And strangely enough, the way it's worked out is that I've been using The Tonight Show to work out my comedy act for the improv, because I'm doing a show that I'm doing a piece at the improv for. Instead of the other way around, you know, using the improv to work out your act for The Tonight Show, I've been testing my material on The Tonight Show for the improv. It's funny if you get it, you know. Anyway.
Oh, jeez. How come it's taken you till age 40 to try out stand-up?
Well, okay, this is maybe hard to believe, but I was really too busy to get to it. It's something I always wanted to do, but I came like right out of college, got a job in advertising, and then realized that was a joke. And then I got in, I saw Second City and auditioned for that, and then got in. And I was in the stage company for about a year, and then the TV show started. And I was in that for 6 or 7 years. And then, you know, and then I did some movies, and then next thing I got married and had a family, and then it was like, wait, slow down. My life is slipping between my fingers, you know? And so I didn't get a chance to get to it until now. I mean, when we were doing SCTV, that was like 7 years of my life where I was like working 18 hours a day, 6 days a week. And to just be able to get your stuff together for the show, you were operating at your maximum capacity, you know. There was really no time for anything at all, even a personal life. That's why most of the people from SCTV have got kids about the same age, got married about the same time, because it wasn't until the show kind of broke and people had some time that they go, oh, I see, there's sex, there's relationships, there's all kinds of things, you know.
I want to ask you about the McKenzie brothers, another sketch that originated on SCTV. This was The Great White North with you and Rick Moranis. What's the story behind how you started doing this parody of Canadians and Canadian TV?
Well, the Canadian show was 2 minutes longer than the American show, and so this is when we were doing the half hour in syndication, and they needed something to fill that difference between the two shows, and they wanted to find something that they could do cheaply as well. So they suggested that we do something Canadian content. Well, we were kind of infuriated by this. That's a kind of a national neurosis in Canada, you know, that they're always talking about their identity and Canadian content and everything. And it's more of a phenomenon, a literary phenomenon, than it is a public phenomenon. But anyway, it's kind of irritating when you're doing a show in Canada with an entire Canadian crew, half the cast is Canadian, most of the writers are Canadian, and then the CBC and your producers turn around and say to you, could you do something Canadian? You know, you morons, this is Canadian already. But they didn't seem to think so. So as a joke, we said to them, well, what do you want us to do? Just put up a map of Canada and dress in ski hats and parkas and, you know, and talk like this, eh? Like, I can't drink beer, like. They said, "Yeah, that'd be great." And could you put a Mountie in the scene too? You know, so that's what we did as a sort of a joke at the producer's expense. And of course, little did we know that it would catch on. You know, again, you know, I've had people say, "How did you plan? What was the design behind these characters? These characters are so typical of Canadian." Well, really, there was none of that depth behind it. And Rick will back me up on this. We were just clowning around. We were improvising. You know, we felt that, you know, Bob and Doug McKenzie have been given like a lot more depth and credit than they deserve, and so we're glad we canned them, you know. They were put to rest, R.I.P. By our hands, you know.
Yeah,
deservedly,
yeah.
So.
Do you think the CBC was sorry that they asked for this Canadian stuff, because they ended up with the kind of characters that wouldn't get you to want to move to Canada, you know?
Yeah, you mean
wasn't
not
exactly,
a flattering.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly good PR for the country.
Well, actually, you know, the strange thing is, there is a sort of a feeling, and it was reflected in the way they were received in Canada, that, you know, any image is better than no image at all. And people would come to us and say, thanks for putting us on the map, eh? You know? And it was like, oh, okay, well, you're welcome.
Dave Thomas is my guest. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Dave Thomas is my guest. He's hosting a 5-part comedy series on CBS. What's the first writing or performing that you did?
Well, let me think. I guess it was, I didn't do anything really, I didn't do anything in high school or public school, grammar school. I guess it was college. I went to a small college in Canada, and I met Marty Short and Eugene Levy there. And there was really no drama school there, or no... or theater school, or film school, I should say, or TV, nothing. It was just a general arts school with a heavy sciences department and a lot of people in engineering. And so we started our own theater group and did plays, you know. And then after a while, we were doing three or four plays a year and not going to any classes at all. I had a ball with these guys in college, and, you know, we were there together for 4 years doing plays. So,
now, you wrote ad copy for a few years before joining SCTV, right?
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of stuff did you write?
Well, what happened was I was in Godspell, and then after Godspell closed, I tried to get jobs in theater, and I couldn't get there. At that time, there's a lot of underground theater stuff going on, and I remember there was one show, I can't remember the name of it, but it was a part that I was, you know, that I read for, and they said, well, yeah, you did good. Actually, we'd like you to, we'd like to consider you for this. And but it opened with me and another girl nude in a video arcade. So I thought, well, you know, I can't invite my parents to come and see this. This is sad, you know. So I actually quit show business. Marty and Eugene joked with me about that Dave went to two auditions and quit showbiz. So I wrote up some fake ads, and then I went through the yellow pages of the phone book and called up the creative directors of ad agencies. And by the time I got to the M's, I got hired at McCann Erickson.
So how'd you get back from advertising back into performance?
I became frustrated and bored there. I mean, there's only so long you can play second fiddle to a box of soap before you start to go, wait, this can't be all there is. And the guy who hired me was a very funny guy. His name is Harry Yates, and he had worked at Doyle Dane Burnback in New York. And when he hired me, he gave me a book called The Ad Man by Jack Dylan. It's a very morbid and depressing book. And at the end, the hero of the book is left on his front lawn. His wife and kids have left him. He's lying in a pool of his own vomit, and his life is completely destroyed and ruined. And Harry said to me, read this book, and if you still want to be in advertising after reading this book, report Monday at 9 a.m. for work. So I always had that book in the back of my head as you know, what the possibilities were, and in their most horrible form. And so then I went down and saw Second City, and I saw, you know, Dan Aykroyd and John Candy and those guys up on stage having a great time. And I started going down there and watching it a lot. And then I heard they were going to open a company in Pasadena, and they were sending three guys down there. They were sending Eugene Levy, Joe Flaherty, and John Candy to Pasadena. And Danny was going to stay, and I loved him and what he did. And so I went and just auditioned. And I auditioned every night for 5 nights. That's what you do. You do the improv sets with them every night for 5 nights. It was a really harrowing experience trying to improvise with Dan Aykroyd and John Candy and Joe Flaherty. I mean, these guys are real pros. But I got in. So I quit advertising so fast. You know, I mean, I couldn't write my letter of resignation quick enough.
What was one of the first improvs you had to do?
Well, I remember there was a life, this was when I was auditioning, there was a life raft scene, and it was Candy, Flaherty, myself, and Aykroyd on stage, and the deal was we were all stranded in a life raft. There was the usual sort of, like, emergency operation that had to be performed on a seaman, and then the sort of, like, don't drink too much of that salt water. All those gags, you know, from the movie Lifeboat and things like that. We exhausted all those. And then Joe bailed out. Joe, that's it. And I can't take it anymore. And he rolled out of the mime boat and swam off stage and through the curtain and exited. And then one by one, like, then somebody else left. And then I get the picture. I'm going to be out here alone. So I went third. And they told me afterwards, they said that was a really good sign, you know, that if people start bailing out and you're smart enough to get out first, then you pass the test, you know.
Oh, you would have had to do a one-man show if you were left.
Yeah, right. And I didn't want to do that. Not at that point.
So what's the status of your show now? How long is it going to continue? Do you know?
Well, I've got 5 of these half hours for CBS and then a one-hour special after that. And then I don't know. I think they're going back to sports after that. I don't really know. There's really no written future. You know, I cannot say it is written. It is not written. It is an unwritten book. I'll be in something. I'll do some other show, you know. I mean, shows keep popping up, you know. I would make some changes in that show. I would do some things differently than I did, you know. So if I did more of those shows, I would do them differently anyway. So, you know, I'm looking forward to the opportunity to make changes in what I do. I get bored with stuff awfully fast.
Did you get bored with SCTV?
Well, I did, actually. That's the sad thing. I know a lot of people, how can he? That's blasphemy, I say. You know, there are a lot of real SCTV fans out there. And but the fact of the matter is, after, you know, working 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, and anyone, no matter how devoted they are to something, would get, you know, tired or frustrated or run down or whatever. And I got to the point where I stopped impersonating, like, Walter Cronkite and Bob Hope and people that America knew about. And I started impersonating, you know, like, writers on the staff and doing them in scenes. And I did, like, Marty Short and Mike Short's father, who used to get up real grouchy in the morning wearing a Hawaiian shirt and only his underwear and a pair of, like, knee socks and his wife's slippers and cook sausages and just bitch and complain at everybody. So I did this piece called Charlie's Kitchen, and it was Charlie Short, Mike and Marty's dad. And an NBC executive came to me and he said, "What the hell is this Charlie's Kitchen?" I said, "Well, that's Mike Short and Marty Short's dad." He said, "Well, what's that supposed to mean to the rest of America?" I said, "Well, really, I don't know. I think it's sort of funny, but if you don't like it, why don't you just cut it?" And he said, "That's self-indulgent is what it is. It's self-indulgent." And he marched off. And then about a week later, he came to me and he said, "Have you seen Charlie's Kitchen?" And I said, "No, I thought you hated it." And he said, "It's great." And what had happened was he had taken a 5.5-minute self-indulgent piece and gone into the editing room himself and cut it down to a 3.5-minute self-indulgent piece, and through the miracle of creative involvement by executives, felt that he had turned the thing around, you know? They're so funny.
Oh, gosh. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Pleasure.
The Dave Thomas Show continues for the next two Monday nights on CBS. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. We'll check on the supertanker Mega Borg in the Gulf of Mexico. The fire aboard the ship is starting to be controlled. There is hope the tanker could be kept afloat. There's an oil spill leaking from that ship, now more than 10 miles long. The Senate Ethics Committee begins an investigation into the affairs of Minnesota Senator David Durenberger. NPR's John Idstey has a report on the savings and loan bailout, answering some of the questions about who may eventually end up paying for that bailout. Linda Gradstein reports on a Soviet emigre family getting settled in the occupied territories. And we'll talk with Jonathan Richman. Jonathan Richman has been called the true spirit of rock and roll.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. If you've always thought of Cleopatra as the ravishing queen with an insatiable appetite for men, there's a new book that says you've got it all wrong. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Cleopatra, Histories, Dreams, and Distortions.
First of all, Cleopatra wasn't really Egyptian. She was Greek. And the asp that bit her wasn't really an asp. It was a cobra. And it bit her on the arm, not the breast. And she was otherwise fully clothed in her royal robes, not at all semi-naked, as so many artists ever since 30 BC have painted her, because of their own sexual hang-ups. Nor was she especially pretty, not even by the standards of her pagan time. As you'd know from the nose stamped on the coins of a realm she managed very nicely, thank you, without any Roman help. She was a working queen who spoke 9 languages, wrote some books, and cut a deal with the Nabataeans for oil rights in the Dead Sea. She was astonishingly celibate half her life. All those Romans kept stopping in Alexandria, not for a one-night stand, but because they needed her money and her naval fleet for their imperial war games. If Julius Caesar fathered 1 child on her, and Antony 3, from them she got in return a little this and a little that, like Lebanon and Syria. plus some prime real estate around Jericho, dates and balsam, from which she made a bundle by leasing it back to King Herod of Judea. Cleo and Antony were in the empire business themselves. Because Octavius won at Actium, he got to write the history books. He also got Virgil to write the Aeneid, glorifying his Augustan self. Lucy Hughes Hallett does for Cleopatra what Marina Warner did for Joan of Arc and the Virgin Mary. First, she demystifies. Then she looks into the reasons for the mystifications, the neuroses of succeeding male cultures that dreamed up whatever new Cleo they needed, lover, killer, bimbo, to mask how they really felt about women. Octavius is Apollo, and Antony is Dionysus, were small fry fantasies compared to the Cleos imagined by Boccaccio, Chaucer, and Dante, Shakespeare and Pascal, Pushkin, Swinburne, and Victor Hugo, Heine, Keats, and Cecil B. DeMille. Not to mention painters like Tiepolo, composers like Handel and Berlioz, postmodernists like Edward Said and Susan Sontag. In the Middle Ages, Cleo killed herself for the love of a man, like Dido and Thisbe. In the Renaissance, love itself was the enemy of reason, sexual passion a disease like madness, the expense of spirit in a waste of shame, damaging to the social order. The Reformation needed a bad girl. Romantics required a man-eating femme fatale, the morbid and mystical, the alien and other, a desert, a sphinx, and a serpent of desire, preferably recumbent, taking everything lying down, often underwater, in extreme torpor and fatal languor, a combination of pornography, window shopping, and tourism. George Bernard Shaw gave us Cleo as sex kitten, an enchanting pet, after which, the dumb broad. Out of their own ennui, decadents invented Elizabeth Taylor and camp. Whatever she looks like, this week or that century, Cleo is always symbolic of female nature versus male culture, what Hughes Hallett calls men's fear of sexuality as incarnated in women, as well as the face of Western racism projected on a lazy, duplicitous, nymphomaniacal Orient. Cleopatra is a wonderful feminist deconstruction with a very witty wink.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine. He's also a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Cleopatra, Histories, Dreams, and Distortions. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tui and Roberta Sharrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Reverend Joseph Engel tells us about his work ministering to prisoners on death row. And we meet actor Joe Morton from the TV series Equal Justice and the movie Brother from Another Planet. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.